VOA's Jeff Custer with this worldwide news update. Palestinian health officials said an Israeli raid Thursday in the occupied West Bank killed at least three people. The operation included airstrikes in the area of the Nur Shams refugee camp. The Israeli military said it was targeting terrorist infrastructure and that it killed a Hamas militant who was involved in planning attacks. At U.S. State Department briefing late Wednesday, spokesman Matthew Miller said senior White House officials Brett McGurk and Amos Hochstein were scheduled to be in Israel Thursday to discuss a wide range of issues, including ceasefire agreements in Gaza and Lebanon.
And one of the things that they are going to discuss is how we can find a diplomatic resolution that fully implements a UN Security Council Resolution 1701, something that we have not seen over the past few years.
The 2006 Resolution 1701 was aimed at ending hostilities between Hezbollah and Israel and included creating a buffer zone between southern Lebanon and northern Israel. The governor of northeastern Ukraine's Kharkiv region said Thursday one person was dead and 29 others injured after a Russian missile strike on a residential building. Oleh Siniobov said on his Telegram account the person killed in the late Wednesday attack was 11 years old. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the Russian attack hit a nine-story building, and he reiterated his calls for more help in defending Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Wednesday that North Korean troops wearing Russian uniforms and carrying Russian equipment are moving to the Kursk region near Ukraine. Following meetings with his South Korean counterpart, Kim Jong-hyun, at the Pentagon, Austin called the deployment a dangerous and destabilizing escalation.
The evidence now suggests that North Korea has sent around 10,000 soldiers to train in eastern Russia. And I am increasingly concerned that the Kremlin plans to use these North Korean soldiers to support Russia's combat operations in Russia's Kursk region near the border with Ukraine.
South Korea's Defense Minister Kim said he believes the deployment could further heighten tensions between North and South Korea. This is VOA News. Meanwhile, North Korea said it tested an intercontinental ballistic missile Thursday, upgrading what it called the world's most powerful strategic weapon, as South Korea warned the North could be getting missile technology from Russia in exchange for helping with the war in Ukraine. Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reports.
State media KCNA reported that leader Kim Jong-un was on hand for the launch, which he was quoted as saying was a, quote, appropriate military action intended to demonstrate the North's, quote, counteraction will to its rivals. The test drew swift condemnation from the United States, Japan, and South Korea. Shin Sung-ki, head of research on North Korea's military at the Korea Institute for Defense Analyses, said the launch was likely to test an improved version of an existing ICBM, possibly developed with help from Russia. He said the move could also be an attempt to influence the U.S. presidential election, now less than a week away.
That was Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reporting. At least 95 people have been killed in possibly the deadliest flooding to hit Spain in its modern history. After local authorities reported Wednesday torrential rain battered the eastern region of Valencia, sweeping away bridges and buildings. Reuters correspondent Ryan Chang reports.
Meteorologists say a year's worth of rain had fallen in 8 hours in parts of the eastern region of Valencia Tuesday. Authorities plan for more rescue operations on Thursday, and the death toll is expected to rise. In Utiel, locals combed through the mud and debris, cleaning up what's left of their livelihoods.
La pena.
60-year-old teacher Encarna got emotional as she spoke about the pain she felt for all those who lost their lives in the flooding. Another Utiel resident, grocer Amadeo Ibanez, said he felt powerless as the river rose in half an hour, and he lost almost everything in that time.
That was Reuters correspondent Ryan Chang reporting. With the U.S. national elections just 5 days away, a new poll from the Associated Press indicates a majority of U.S. residents are feeling a lot of anxiety. AP correspondent Donna Water reports.
7 in 10 Americans who responded to a poll by the Associated Press and the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research say they're feeling anxious or frustrated about the 2024 presidential campaign. Only one-third say they feel excited. Even though the 2020 election happened during a deadly pandemic, some voters say they're even more anxious now than they were 4 years ago. About 80% of Democrats say they're anxious about this election, up slightly from around 75% in 2020. A little more than 66% of Republicans say they're anxious about this election, compared to 60% of Republicans in 2020. Donna Water, Washington.
That wraps up this news update, but the world and the news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Africa needs China. It's the largest foreign investor, the largest builder of infrastructure in Africa. We need the European Union. Our exports to Europe are much higher value than they are to China. And we need the deep pockets of capital in the U.S. to develop and reduce poverty.
That's Jackie Sillers, head of South Africa's Institute for Security Studies. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. presidential candidates are making their final pitches for votes for Tuesday's election. And in Sudan's biggest city, community-funded soup kitchens are feeding the needy with little international help. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The two candidates for U.S. president are making what they call their closing arguments to voters in this final week before the election. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Prasuti brings us the sights and sounds from two rallies.
In this final week, the presidential campaigns take on the air of a court case.
Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
These are closing arguments, with voters acting as the jury until Tuesday. Former President Donald Trump making his case about the economy and immigration in Madison Square Garden, the epicenter of New York City.
Kamala Harris has shattered our middle class. After years of building up foreign nations, defending foreign borders, and protecting foreign lands, we are finally going to build up our country, defend our borders, and protect our citizens. It's called America First.
The 20,000-seat arena was packed. Some voters waited overnight to get in.
It'd be kind of cool to have a role model, but honestly, I think Trump will do a really good job with the administration and with foreign affairs.
He's outspoken. He's unscripted. And he resonates with me.
I really see that Trump is going to take us to the next level.
For her rebuttal, Vice President Kamala Harris chose the Ellipse in Washington with the backdrop of the White House, the future home for one of the presidential contenders.
It is time for a new generation of leadership in America.
Harris laid out her own vision for America, seeking to strike a contrast with Trump.
It is time to turn the page on the drama and the conflict. I will enact the first ever federal ban on price gouging on groceries. Cap the price of insulin and limit out-of-pocket prescription costs for all Americans.
Again, tens of thousands attended.
The first woman president, I would love to see that in my lifespan.
I am a gay man, and me personally, I like to keep my rights.
She says she supports abortion rights, pro-choice, a woman's right to choose, and I believe that she will ensure that there is not a national abortion ban enacted under her presidency.
Given how close the race is, the election may be too close to call on Tuesday night. Lawsuits are already underway in some states over ballot counting and voter eligibility. Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News on the Ellipse.
Some international relation analysts say the outcome of next week's election in the United States will have a profound influence on Washington's relation with Africa, especially regarding trade, security, and climate change initiatives. Darren Taylor reports.
Several Africa watchers are concerned that another Donald Trump presidency will impact negatively on the continent. The Republican candidate is likely to scale down America's presence in Africa, they say, exactly at a time, they say, when Washington should do the opposite. But Peter Palm, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council Policy Research Organization and a veteran U.S. diplomat in Africa, doesn't see that happening.
Although there's stark contrast between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, though they're very, very different people, very, very different policies, traditionally, Africa policy has had great continuity between administrations, both Democratic and Republican.
He was speaking in a recent webinar organized by the Policy Center for the New South. Some skeptics do, however, expect Trump to scrap the U.S.'s preferential trade agreement with Africa should he win the White House. Under the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, 35 African countries export thousands of products tax-free to the U.S., earning them billions of dollars. Trump has said America shouldn't be rewarding countries that have close ties with Washington's opponents, most notably China. Yaki Salia, head of South Africa's Institute for Security Studies, is concerned that a second Trump administration will try to force Africa to end partnerships with China, Russia, and others the U.S. is opposed to.
The problem for Africa is that Africa is often forced to make a choice. We can't make that choice. Africa needs China. It's the largest foreign investor, the largest builder of infrastructure in Africa. We need the European Union. Our exports to Europe are much higher value than they are to China. And we need the deep pockets of capital in the U.S. to develop and reduce poverty. We can't choose the one above the other, even as our developmental future will increasingly be determined by a rising Asia.
He tells VOA he thinks Harris is more likely to see value in strengthening relations with Africa and not condemning African countries for their foreign policy choices. On security in Africa, says Pam, Harris and Trump appear to have very different approaches.
I served in the Trump administration as the special envoy for the Sahel. And at the time, we had the first coup in Mali. Despite the fact that we were very quick to condemn the coup, we continued to engage constructively with those that took power. We maintained a pragmatic approach. The Biden-Harris administration has been perhaps a little more doctrinaire. The result has been not only a rupture in a lot of ties with Mali, but the expulsion of U.S. military personnel and bases from Niger. So I'm not sure about the efficacy of that policy. A Trump presidency may be more pragmatic in its dealing with security.
African futures analyst Kofi Kwaku says whether Trump or Harris is in the White House, Africa must get its own house in order.
Africa's world in terms of possibility will only be realized on the quality of the leadership that runs it. And at the heart of this liberation is the sense that those who are going to run these African countries must have a sense of sovereignty, thinking about Africa, not just Africa first, but thinking that Africa must really rely on itself and avoid the dependency that crippled it for so many centuries. And so our hopes and fears must rely on this quality of leadership.
Policies by Harris or Trump can help to develop Africa, he says. But ultimately, the continent's future lies in its hands, not Washington's. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Continuing our series on U.S. election, African voices, here in studio with me is Kamlam Naido, better known as Rani, from Johannesburg, South Africa. She's been in the U.S. to look at the U.S. elections and attended Vice President Kamala Harris's last major rally for the presidency earlier this week in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Kamalam.
Thank you.
So, Rani, what has excited you so far about the U.S. and the U.S. election?
The people, the American people, are very friendly and very helpful.
Very helpful, very friendly. So what else?
I love the places of interest. I like the Great Canyon and the Statue of Liberty and the Niagara Falls are so beautiful. I really enjoyed the sightseeing here in America.
And you also attended Vice President Kamala Harris's last major rally for the presidency earlier this week in Washington, D.C. How was that experience?
Oh, that was an awesome experience. The people there were so vibrant. And, you know, being with 75,000 people was an experience to, you know, it's a memorable experience. I haven't seen people like that, full of fun and happy-go-lucky and, you know, people with their little children, their pets. You know, it was a good experience.
And for you, it's an added bonus.
Yes.
You and Kamala Harris have something in common, the Indian heritage.
Yes.
Could you talk a little about that?
We are both first generation Indian. My dad is from India and her mom is from India. So that makes the difference. And Indian people are very passive and they're very loyal. So I think, you know, by listening to his speech, I think, you know, it was very good.
So lastly, Rani, what will you be taking back to South Africa as far as, like, memories of America?
Oh, of the American people. The American people are awesome. And the president... I just wanted to say that I hope the next president, whomever that is, will honor their commitment to the people and build a better future for everyone. And I wish the American people good health.
With that positive thought, I say thank you very much, Kamala Manaido from Johannesburg, South Africa. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs on WhatsApp. The number is +1 202-258-3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. With just a few days until the United States presidential election, some parents in Guinea are worried about former President Donald Trump's pledge to deport undocumented immigrants if he wins a new term. Thousands of citizens from Guinea are thought to be in the U.S. without visas. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
Three of Ibrahim Kamara's children entered the United States via Nicaragua without a visa. He says he's among thousands of Guinean families who will be hit hard if their sons and daughters are sent home, as former U.S. President Donald Trump vows to do if he wins re-election.
Je suis vraiment inquiet parce que si il renvoie nos enfants encore en Guinée, cela veut dire que plusieurs familles vont encore souffrir.
He says he's really worried because if the U.S. sends back their children, some families will suffer for years. He says their children travel to the United States in search of greener pastures. He says if they send back their children, that will mean real disaster. The exact number of Guineans who have crossed into the U.S. without visas is not known, but it's believed to be in the thousands. The New York Times newspaper and other publications have reported that the number of undocumented migrants arriving in the U.S. from sub-Saharan Africa jumped to more than 58,000 in 2003 from around 13,000 the year before. The Associated Press also reported that last year, U.S. border agents arrested more than 4,000 Guineans attempting to enter. Immigration is a major issue in this year's presidential campaign, with more than half of all Americans saying the country needs legal reforms to cut down the number of undocumented arrivals. Former President Donald Trump, the Republican Party candidate, has vowed to deport millions of undocumented migrants in the country. About 11 million undocumented migrants are thought to live in the country, the U.S. government has said, and about 2 million a year try to enter, according to Customs and Border Patrol data. Many Guinean parents financially support their children on the long trip to the United States, selling property or borrowing money. Guinean Hawaba worries about her son being deported. Clip Hawaba.
Je dors difficilement la nuit depuis que j'ai appris la nouvelle que si un des candidats aux élections aux États-Unis gagne les élections, il va renvoyer nos enfants qui vivent aux États-Unis.
She says she hardly sleeps at night since she had the news that one of the U.S. candidates has promised to deport all our children without proper documents in the United States. She says she is really worried and that her husband sold their home to send their children to the United States. Now they are renting. So if their son is repatriated, it means it will be all over for the family. Guinean Alusen Conte took out a loan so his son could go to the United States and hopes his son will get a job and repay the money.
J'ai pris des dettes pour envoyer mon fils maintenant. Je sais pas là où je suis. Depuis, j'ai appris que après l'élection, si Donald Trump gagne, il va renvoyer nos enfants.
He says he has a debt over $10,000 and asks where he can get that money. He says he's looking forward to his son to start working and build him a house and provide them a decent life. To a lesser degree than Donald Trump, Democrat Party candidate Kamala Harris has also spoken about the need for immigration reform. She often has noted that Republican members of Congress refused to pass bipartisan legislation that would have given more funding for border enforcement and change immigration laws after Trump urged Republicans to kill the deal. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
In war-stricken Omdurman, Sudan's most populous city, community-funded soup kitchens are feeding those in need with little help from the international community. As one part of Sudan faces famine, the world's first in 7 years, the U.S. and others have called on the warring sides to allow unfettered access for aid groups. Henry Wilkins reports.
When the fighting started in Omdurman, Sudan's most populous city, Ahid Mohammed Ali refused to flee. He said he would rather die in his home than suffer the pain of long-term displacement. Along with other members of the community, they pooled their resources and began cooking and sharing meals for those who remained in the city.
Because we have very few resources, we created a WhatsApp group and a Facebook page. And we also have TikTok and started trying to spread awareness of what we were doing. Then we started receiving donations from the Sudanese diaspora abroad.
With the city's economy in a state of collapse since Sudan's war started in April 2023, Ali says his makeshift soup kitchen now feeds 200 families every day, thanks to private donations. Others like it have sprung up across the city with almost no support from international aid groups. An October statement by 11 of the world's biggest humanitarian donors, including USAID, says both sides in the conflict are obstructing aid groups' access to cities like Omdurman. It says systemic obstruction of local and international humanitarian efforts is at the root of this famine. One part of Sudan is undergoing the world's first famine in 7 years, while large swathes of the country are one step away from falling into famine. In an interview with VOA, Sudan's finance minister said aid groups are being given all the access they need.
Yes, of course they have the access. You can talk to them, and actually no one have obstructed their movements around.
VOA spoke to Refugees International, an advocacy group for displaced people that partners with various international aid groups. Daniel Sullivan is director for Africa, Asia, and the Middle East at the organization.
To claim that international NGOs and UN agencies have all the access they need is blatantly false. I've spoken to many partner groups that are working on the ground, and whether it's the direct blatant blocking of aid or the slow rolling of visas and other bureaucratic impediments. Clearly, people who are working on the ground do not feel that they have the access they need. And
the opposing side in Sudan's conflict, the Rapid Support Forces, did not respond to a request for comment. UN experts have said that due to the lack of access for traditional aid groups, soup kitchens like Ali's are leading the way for the delivery of food aid in Sudan. But Ali says aid groups need to help.
I ask God Almighty to help us reach international aid groups. Reaching these organizations is very important.
He says he's only able to serve one meal a day for those who arrive on his doorstep. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Omdurman, Sudan.
The United Nations food agencies today said severe food crises threaten hundreds of thousands of people in vulnerable areas, including Sudan, South Sudan, Mali, the Palestinian territories, and Haiti, where populations face or are near famine. In a new report, UN Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program warns conflicts, economic instability, and climate shocks, combined with reduced funding for emergency food and agriculture assistance, are driving alarming levels of acute food insecurity. The two agencies say acute food insecurity is projected to worsen across 16 hunger hotspots during the next 6 months in 14 countries and two regions. The report classifies Chad, Lebanon, Myanmar, Mozambique, Nigeria, the Syrian Arab Republic, and Yemen as hotspots of very high concern, where large numbers of people are facing or are projected to face critical levels of acute food insecurity. Nigerian authorities plan to convert 1 million gasoline engine vehicles to run on cheaper, cleaner, compressed natural gas, or CNG, by the year 2027. Nigeria has some of the largest gas reserves in the world, but with only a few CNG filling stations available in the country, many who have converted the vehicles are facing a new challenge. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Vehicles stretching hundreds of meters in line for gasoline is not unusual in Nigeria, but this is different. Here, desperate commuters are hoping to get compressed natural gas at one of the few centers dispensing CNG across the country. Some, like Yahaya Ibrahim, have been here grounded for 5 days.
We dropped load for Katsina.
After I dropped off my load in Katsina State, I came here because the remaining gas will not take me back to Kogi State, where I came from.
Taxi driver Abdullahi Ashiru converted his vehicle 3 months ago and spends only a third of his daily gasoline budget to run on natural gas. But he says the struggle to get CNG lately has been frustrating.
I've been here since, let's say, since 11 o'clock. See, now what is time now? At least I think to 4, I'm buying CNG.
Nigeria has the largest gas reserves in Africa, about 209 trillion cubic feet. And last year, shortly after scrapping gasoline subsidies, the government launched a robust natural gas transition initiative, including a plan to have 1 million CNG-powered vehicles on the roads in 3 years. Natural gas is a cheaper and cleaner fueling alternative for Nigerians, but Nigerian regulatory authorities say there are less than 50 compressed natural gas compression stations like this for the more than 200 million Nigerians trying to replace pricey fossil fuels like petrol and diesel. Gasoline prices have increased about sixfold since the government scrapped its subsidy program last year, making more people eager to switch to natural gas. There are currently about 130 conversion centers, and authorities aim to establish hundreds more across the country by 2027. But many, like Abuja resident Omotayo James, say there's no need if CNG cannot be readily available.
At least we should have like 7 points in Abuja that is working only on him before you start conversing for conversion. This is a federal road. This is a road that leads to airport. I don't know how Asu Adibola Ahmed want to go to airport and they want to stop car and they are seeing people on the road like this.
Last month, the government announced a plan to raise $250 million by 2027 to support CNG infrastructure development. But many say that intervention can come soon enough. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suwuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Kayla Williams, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.